ahead and take the speed up your number one now, runway 27 clear to land green dot. Welcome to Oshkosh, guys.
Hello and welcome to the Green Dot, EAA's podcast for anyone and everyone who loves aviation. I'm one of your hosts. My name is Hal Bryan. I'm EAA's managing editor for print and digital content and publications. Over there, across the table, it is...
Tom Charpentier, government relations director, and your other host.
Excellent. And Tom, we are joined via the magic of the internet today by someone whose job category we don't think we've ever had on before. We were just talking about that a moment ago before we went on. And that is an artist and a prop maker. His name is Ryan Nagata. Ryan, welcome to the Green Dot.
Hi, how are you? Thank you for having me.
Thank you for joining us. We're thrilled to have you. Now, as you'll see throughout the course of this discussion with Ryan, he's got a fascinating series of interests and a lot of diverse talents. But one of the things that really brought him to our attention, sort of got him on our radar and connected him with our world, is the construction of a reproduction of an X-15 spacesuit that was done for Joe and Jeannie Engel and is now on display in the EA Aviation Museum as part of that collection.
Yeah, actually, absolutely. I actually helped Chris and Amelia set up that suit in its current display case, and it is. I thought it was a real suit actually until Chris explained it to me.
Oh, wow.
Details on it, Ryan, are extraordinary. And of course, this is audio only. It's a difficult thing to get across, but anybody, anytime you come in and visit us here in the museum, it's something that people are really going to want to look at. Something that's most impactful to me is that there's what I, and certainly as something of a layperson in this area, but what I would describe as the perfect amount of weathering. Doesn't look like somebody just took some Reynolds wrap and wrapped it around a mannequin and said, look at my cool space suit. This, everything about this, the heft of it, just a little bit of not age per se, but just, right. Just an organic quality to it looks real. So Ryan, tell us about how you came to build that, and if you could also kind of in parallel tell us about how you made at least one other X-15 suit that many more people have seen.
Yeah, well, that's probably where I'd have to start because that's how I met the Engels. So I make, among other things, spacesuit replicas for museum exhibits or films sometimes, and sometimes private collections. And so I got connected with the people who made First Man, the Neil Armstrong biopic that came out a few years ago. And most of the suits in that movie were made by a prop house in LA that does a lot of spacesuits for movies. It's this company called Global Effects. But they didn't make the X-15 pressure suit because they wanted to show Neil Armstrong in his early test pilot career. And I don't think there's ever been an X-15 suit aside from that X-15 movie that came out, I think, in the 60s. There's never been an X-15 scene in a movie, so there was no suit to rent. So they came to me and asked me to do a reproduction of that suit. And I happen to have a friend in Southern California who has a huge collection of vintage pressure suits and space suits even. And he had all of the components. It wasn't an actual X-15 suit, but a lot of the components of that suit are just general high pressure, high altitude suit components. So he let me come in there and measure everything. And I put together a pretty good replica of Neil Armstrong's X-15 suit for that movie. So he's wearing my suit in that film. And Joe Engel, being the last living X-15 pilot, he was the technical advisor on that film for the X-15 scenes. And he and his wife, came in, and I recognized him immediately. I had no idea he was going to be the technical advisor, but he walked in, and I said, "Oh my God, that's Joe Engel." And you know, went over to meet him, and they're showing him the, you know, the X-15 mock-ups they did for the movie and this and that, and he said, not knowing that I had done the suit replica, he said, where's the suit? I really want to see the suit." So I took him back and showed him the X-15 suit, and he loved it. And he told me that was, you know, he wore so many different pressure suits and space suits in his career. I mean, he had a very, very long career.
Absolutely.
And he said this was by far his favorite suit that he ever wore, because it was all silver, and when you wore it, you just felt like a real spaceman, he said. And so, yeah, he always liked the suit that I did, and I think Jeannie, his wife, took notice of that. And so finally, years later, you know, coming back to today, you know, you have that exhibit about Joe at the museum, and so she contacted me about making a replica of his suit for that museum. So I was very happy to oblige, and there's some differences from the Neil Armstrong suit, and I made some improvements overall to the design, but that's kind of how it happened.
So what's the very first thing that you do? I mean, obviously there's research, I'm sure, and photos, and you mentioned your friend with his collection and looking at things, but when you're sitting down at your workbench or in your shop to make a spacesuit, where do you start?
Well, it almost always starts with photographs, because I specialize in a lot of the historical NASA stuff, and fortunately the Smithsonian has photographed all of the suits in great detail that they have in their collection. So I usually start with pictures. And then, you know, when I started out doing this, it's probably, 8 years ago now is when I started making these kind of high-end suit replicas. I didn't know anybody, so it was all just from photographs. And then slowly over the years, I became more known in this space. And I would, you know, I went to the Smithsonian to, you know, I'm now friends with the Air and Space Museum people who work there. And I've been to ILC Dover that made the Apollo suits. Wow. And I have a very good friend there. And he let me come in there one day and just spend all day measuring a lot of the old hardware that they have there. They don't have much anymore, but there's still some. And a lot of times private collectors will reach out and they often want something. Like I'll give you an example. So somebody had won on the Apollo suit, the backpack, it's called the Pliss, mm-hmm. That has a thermal cover on it, and he wanted a shell to be fabricated to put inside the thermal cover, and then he wanted there's a secondary emergency oxygen unit on top called the OPS, and he wanted a replica OPS put on the top. So he basically wanted a full backpack. So he sent me, in exchange for, you know, he sent me the original Pliss thermal cover, and I patterned it out, and you know, now I have the pattern, a very accurate pattern to make replicas of those. But I kind of did that in exchange for, you know, the work of making a display for him. And that's happened countless times now, where, you know, people have sent me stuff and I've gotten to measure real pieces. So, you know, as time goes by, my suits get more and more accurate. So the X-15 collector friend of mine, he's got tons of stuff and often has requests for like missing parts on his suits and things. So I get to, you know, measure things in his collection and pattern stuff. And so it's kind of an ongoing process.
So as far as material selection goes, I mean, I assume you use some kind of substitute for the real beta cloth and stuff like that. Is there like a kind of a cross reference sheet that folks in the business use to come up with stuff that looks and feels the same?
Yeah. So in the case of the Apollo suit, the outer covering was beta cloth, and you can still buy beta cloth from manufacturers. It's still used in aerospace, not really on suits. It's not an ideal fabric for suits because it's fiberglass. The fibers are kind of fragile. Nowadays, you know, the EMU suits are ortho fabric. It's much more durable, but they still make it. But it's pretty expensive. So I've actually made a couple of suits for people that wanted them out of beta cloth. You know, I try and source the original materials. The weave is not quite the same as what was on the Apollo suits. They don't make it anymore. But usually most people don't want that because it's super expensive and it's fragile. So I usually use like a nylon type fabric that looks, you know, similar from a few feet away. I mean, most people don't know the difference. In the case of the X-15 suit, that was like a silver. I tried to make a so the suit for the movie was a custom made nylon fabric that had like a silver coating put on it, and it looked kind of like the original fabric. For the one I did for your museum, it was a cotton-based fabric that had the silver coating because it just, I thought it would last longer. You know, a movie costume only has to last as long as the movie, but, you know, you want a museum to exhibit to last as long as possible. But it's funny story, though. Right after I finished Joe's suit for the museum, a friend that I have at David Clark, the company that made the original X-15 suits, he said they were going through a bunch of stuff and throwing it away, and they found a huge roll of the original X-15 aluminized nylon fabric.
Are you serious? No kidding.
So he said they were going to throw it away. So he just sent me a bunch of it. It's pretty cool. It's a piece of history. I don't know if you know much about that, the history of that silver fabric, but it's really. They were doing experiments at David Clark for, you know, like heat resistance. And so they had put this aluminized coating on a nylon fabric. And I don't think it actually did a whole lot, but it looked pretty cool. And Scott Crossfield was, as the story goes, was touring the facility at David Clark. And he saw that fabric on a table. And he said, you should make the X-15 suits out of this. And they said, well, it doesn't really do anything. He said, no, this is like, you know, so much of this program and the space program is about PR. Like, this is what a spaceman is supposed to look like. So they made those X-15 suits silver. And they did the same thing with Mercury. The Mercury suit was based on the high-altitude Navy Mark IV suit, which was just sort of a military sage green color. And they made that silver too.
That's interesting.
Yeah. For no other reason that it looked like a spaceman should.
I had no idea that they actually did like make some aesthetic considerations on the suit that make it actually look like Buck Rogers. That's really
right.
Cool.
Well, you know, Buck Rogers brings you more bucks, right?
Yeah. Right.
Yeah. Though that was the early days, so the first Gemini suits that they were working on were also silver, but the coating sort of rubs off, and it has some problems with it, and it's expensive. So they just switched to white after that. They lost the silver color.
So now that original fabric that you got from David Clark, and of course David Clark, very well known in our world as the light green headset people. That's, you know, all but ubiquitous in aviation.
Yeah.
You know, did you get enough of that to make a suit, or do you have plans to make something?
Yeah,
from
it? I have I have 7 yards of it, which is enough to make one suit. And I was planning to make a Mercury suit out of it. It's very similar. It's not exactly the same, but it's very similar to the Mercury suit. So BF Goodrich did the Mercury suit, and they worked with the Navy primarily. And David Clark at the time made the Gemini suits and the X-15 suit, and they were primarily an Air Force contractor. So they were two different worlds. So the Mercury suit used that BF Goodrich Navy fabric, which is just slightly different weave, but very similar, very, very similar. So,
Going back just for a second to, I guess the first suit you made for First Man, and you know, you mentioned you use a different fabric, and I guess I was curious if there were any other, I guess two questions. One, any concessions to the needs of Hollywood in terms of, you know, something that needed to be worn by an actor potentially for a long period, and then also any differences between a suit that's kind of meant more to be worn versus something like, you know, I'd never say that what you made for us is not worthy of being worn or meant to be worn, but it is a display piece. So any differences there?
Yeah. So in terms of accuracy, so the X-15 suit has the silver cover layer, and underneath is an orange pressure suit, which is pretty much it was the Air Force high altitude AP-22S-2 full pressure suit. That's what it was called. And that suit has, you know, its own pressure sealing zipper that sort of goes down the sides of the chest and around the back. And there's all kinds of fittings and stuff on that suit. And because it was covered by the silver cover layer, I only, and you know, we're kind of in a time crunch. I only made what you can see when you unzip the front of that silver cover layer. So there's really nothing. It's just sort of a plain orange suit beyond that. And I did the same thing for the angle suit in your collection. Yeah, I mean, there's all kinds of things you have to do to make it more wearable, you know, more comfortable for an actor. One of them is that there's an emergency oxygen backpack that straps to the back of the suit, and it's thin. It's sort of this rectangular, curved rectangular pack that sits on the back. You probably saw it. And the real one is an oxygen tank. So it's like a row of several very skinny oxygen tanks arranged in sort of a flat formation that can fit into the ejection seat. And you know, for the movie, I actually didn't know, you know, I wasn't in touch with the art department making the mock-ups. I didn't know what, you know, suits, this is a problem with movies, is that, you know, the suits for real, you know, NASA or, you know, military stuff are meant to integrate with the craft. So at some point somebody has to talk to another person about, you know, what the hose fitting is, if it's going to fit, you know, into the, whatever's in the spacecraft or aircraft.
Sure.
I didn't know what the X-15 suit or excuse me, the X-15 mockup was going to be on the movie. So, you know, I didn't know if there would be a space for that backpack to sit, you know, in the seat. So I just made it out of a piece of foam, which I figured, you know, if Ryan was sitting back on a flat piece of foam, it'd probably be more comfortable than, you know, some kind of oxygen tank contraption. Let's see, for the angle suit, it was fairly similar to the movie suit. I kind of just duplicated what I did for the movie, but you know, there were some additional ventilation things on the movie suit, and they were not actually accurate. They cut some extra holes in places and put some mesh so, you know, air could pass through. And you didn't see it on camera, but and it wasn't accurate. So I didn't put any of that stuff on the angle suit.
Yeah. So Ryan, how do you do things? Like you mentioned, fittings and not knowing sort of what's going to be there, what's going to connect or not. But, we talked about fabric and how you come up with that, but what do you do for hardware, for little hose fittings and collars where helmets are going to fit?
And the helmet.
And the helmet itself.
Yeah. So that's also kind of evolved over time. And I do it different ways. So starting with the highest level of accuracy. So for my Apollo suit, like my own personal suit that I've been working on for, 5, 6, 7 years, and it's still not finished. It's right now, it's just the pressure garment inside. I don't know if you've ever seen pictures of that Apollo suit without the white cover. It's a blue suit, actually. So I've replicated that. I haven't done the thermal cover yet. But anyway, so for that suit, all of the disconnects are machined anodized aluminum, which is what the real ones are made out of, because I'm trying to make an exact replica as possible. And I actually had to, I didn't know how to machine things. And, going to a machine shop or like a CNC place, it would have been tremendously expensive to get that done. I mean, I think to machine everything on the Apollo suit, would be well over $100,000, I think. And that's not getting even all the details. That would just be sort of a cosmetic replica. So I bought a mill and a lathe, and I basically taught myself how to machine. And so I machined most of the disconnects for my Apollo suit on my own machine. The only thing that I couldn't do was the neck ring because it was too big. So I actually went to a machine shop for that, and I actually know the owner of this shop, and he gave me a good price on it. But for the neck ring, I duplicated the real ring almost exactly, including all the internal. So one of the things in my my network of people and stuff, I met a guy who worked with it was called the Hamilton Sunstrand Heritage Team. So it was a Hamilton Standard made they were a subcontractor of the Apollo suit, and they made the Pliss. And right. I guess there was a group of people. So Hamilton Standard became Hamilton Sunstrand. And there was a group of people that were, trying to preserve, the work that Hamilton had done on the Apollo suit. And there were some guys there trying to replicate a suit. And one of the things they had done was they had taken one of those neck rings apart and cast all of the pieces in resin. This was years ago. A guy never finished his suit, but then he saw the work that I did and he realized I could probably do it better than he could. So he sent me all of this research and stuff that he had in exchange for making him a suit. And one of the things was that Apollo neck ring cast in its component parts. And so I was able to duplicate the function of it exactly. So like for my high end suits, and I've only done this for my own suit, I make them exactly like the real ones. But for most suits, like for a movie or something, I usually do cast resin pieces, out of molds. And they're just painted to look like metal, just like typical Hollywood costume type stuff. It's just because not only are the metal disconnects prohibitively expensive for most people, although I have met some collectors who are very wealthy, who I'm sure would be happy to pay for metal disconnects, but I don't want to do it because it was just such a nightmare to put it all together. It was very, very labor intensive. And I mean, I have a whole story about the engraving and getting that done as well. I mean, it's very hard to find a good engraver who can engrave these aerospace parts. I don't want to deal with it. So people have asked, and I think I've only done it once. I did some metal disconnects for one collector once, but that was it.
Wow. You know, if it's fascinating to me to hear the mention of these, you know, these companies that we know so well in our world for different reasons. We mentioned David Clark, of course, headsets. You're talking about Hamilton Standard, who became Hamilton Sunstrand. Oh, yeah.
They used to make propellers.
Yeah, and in our world, I mean, Hamilton Standard means propeller, metal props from the Golden Age, and you come to Oshkosh for AirVenture, and you'll see, I don't know, hundreds and hundreds of Hamilton Standard props and that great logo on there and everything else, and it's it's something really intriguing about how, you know, they companies like that evolved and became subcontractors and had, you know, small but vital and very interesting pieces of the program. And then, you know, how through your research, you're, you know, reverse engineering all that.
You know, it's funny you mentioned that, Hal, because I actually knew Hamilton Standard growing up in Connecticut as a spacesuit company.
Oh, well, there you go.
Because that's what they were doing at the time. And they were working on the shuttle program at the time. And I remember I took at least one field trip to their plant.
Oh, wow.
And they showed us all the spacesuits and all that stuff when I was a little kid. It was really neat.
Now, did you shove anything into your pocket on that field trip that Ryan could use?
You know, I'll check. If I have anything, I'll send it your way, Ryan.
Oh, thank you. I appreciate it. So all the companies that make spacesuits do something else, because there's not a lot of money in spacesuits. I mean, because you only need to, you know, you get these government contracts to make a few suits and that's it. So, you know, a lot of David Clark, ILC, Hamilton Standard, they're all known for doing other things. I mean, ILC was a division of Playtex. So they made bras and girdles. That's like primarily what they did. And the spacesuit thing was just, you know, something on the side that they had an interest in doing. They all do something else primarily, and spacesuits on the side.
That's actually that leads to an interesting question that maybe goes back to the X-15 work, and of course the Apollo stuff too. So nowadays, I know that there were only like, I don't know, something like 6 or 8 space shuttle EVA suits ever made. I think they built two that they lost one or two of them on Challenger and had to rebuild a few of them. But I think that was basically it. And they would just, you know, refurbish those suits and then send them back on flights and stuff like that. Back when they were doing Apollo, as I'm sure you know, they made the suit for the astronaut. Is that what they did on the X-15 as well?
The X-15 suits were custom made for the pilots. It's based on on the standard Air Force high altitude suit of the time, which I think came in standard sizes, but the X-15 suit they did tailor to each pilot. Yes,
you know that you said the word tailor, and that kind of got me thinking. And Ryan, and looking over sort of the variety of your work beyond suits, you've done all kinds of fascinating props, either from films or of your own design or inspired by other properties, you know, cool ray guns and lightsabers and things like this. You strike me as the kind of gifted artist that I envy who can think it up and then actually make it real. So when I think about you making a spacesuit, I'm thinking about, okay, where do you find cool silver fabric? Like we've talked about, where do you do the fittings? How do you do the helmet? How do you do all this stuff? But somewhere along the line, you had to become a tailor as well. How did that sort of factor into it? Because that seems like that would be like you're almost switching hats there.
Yeah, that's true. So, I mean, nobody I've found really does exactly what I do. The closest is like the Hollywood prop houses that do spacesuits, but they're usually, you know, there's many people there that specialize in different things. So there's the people that sew the soft goods, you know, they're the people that fabricate the hard things, and there's painters and, you know, it's a whole crew of people. But I more or less work by myself. So I kind of had to learn to do everything. And sewing is like, when I was growing up, like I wanted to work in the movies. And so I would make a lot of home movies, like in middle school, high school. And one of the things that we needed were costumes for things. I also did a World War II thing once, which, you know, they didn't, it was getting harder and harder to find that vintage field gear. And so, you know, I had to kind of learn to sew this stuff myself. This was like 25 years ago. Over time, just, I've always liked making costumes and things. I've just gotten better and better at sewing. I'm just all pretty much self-taught. But you know, it's interesting because there is sort of a, at least there was somewhat of a stigma against men learning to sew, at least when I was younger. And so it was not something that I was like proud of necessarily, that I could sew really well. But it's funny. Actually, it was Adam Savage, who is now a very good friend of mine. I saw him on an episode of Mythbusters once, and I don't remember. I think he had to sew a sail or something for a sailboat, and he pulled out a sewing machine and started sewing. And he was talking about how much he loves sewing. I love sewing. And it was after that, I was like, well, I guess this is kind of cool. And so then I just sort of like, I just went full throttle into it and really learned to sew quite well.
You know, in our world, we certainly find a lot of people learning those skills as, you know, such a big part of EAA is building airplanes, it's restoring airplanes. And, you know, we cover so many stories of people in the projects and the restorations that they've done or the airplanes that they've built. And certainly in some cases, when it comes time to do an interior, that's something they farm out to an upholstery shop or something like that. But we hear all the time of somebody who said, you know what, I'm building this airplane. I did the rivets. I did the fiberglass work. Now I've got to figure out how to do upholstery and sew an interior. Then, of course, any fabric covered airplane has rib stitching, and you're sitting there doing pretty significant sewing work with a big fat needle, and it's just another one of those skills that people have in their toolbox.
Yeah, it's true. You know, it's funny you mentioned that because. So I know people that make costumes and stuff, and they do something similar where they make all the, it's typically men will make all the hardware, but then they'll farm out the sewing either to like their wife or their girlfriend or their mother or to somebody else, which is fine. Those other people are great at sewing, but I think when you farm out something to someone else, they don't really necessarily have that crazy obsessive passion that you do. And so it doesn't always like, I mean, I've sewn things where I've done like five or six versions of it. And, you know, my wife looks at it after and says, I don't understand why you didn't just use the first one. And I was like, oh, well, there's a subtle difference in here and the way this kind of curves and this way or that way. And I think you kind of lose that obsessive attention to detail when you farm some of these things out. So I have tried as much as possible to do everything myself. So it all kind of meets my crazy standard, I guess.
Well, that will sure resonate with our audience. Absolutely. I think people know what it's like to want to do it, to do it all and to look back at a finished project and say, you know, that was mine and I did that.
Yeah. I mean, you could farm out experience, but you can't always farm out perfectionism. So,
yeah.
So Ryan, you, you know, in all this work you've done on museums, you know, air and space museums and whatnot, you've done some suits from different eras. And, one of the ones that you've done is a replica of Wiley Post pressure suit. Is that correct?
Yeah. I did that. I did two of those. And they both went to Oklahoma because Wiley Post was from Oklahoma. He's like a big hero there. And so they're in two different, one of them's at the Stafford Museum. And one of them is, I think, at the Oklahoma History Center. And yeah, I did a version of that suit for those two museums. And my friend Adam Savage, who I just mentioned, he had actually just completed a replica of a Wiley Post suit that he wore to a San Diego Comic Con.
Very unique. That's awesome.
And he had just done that. And so this museum contacted me to do a replica. And so I asked Adam, you know, if he could kind of share his research that he had done for that suit with me. And he's just sent me his whole costume that he made to copy. I ended up changing some things. He did it very quickly in one day. So this is not a knock on Adam, but he, you know, a lot of things were done in like EVA foam and like lighter materials, things that like you are more for a costume and not something for a display. So I just kind of upgraded certain things, but that was kind of a fun project too, because that suit looks, it doesn't look anything like a, it looks more like a diving suit. In fact, people, when they look at it, they think, is that like a diving suit or something?
Yeah. Well, it's got that very sort of bucket style helmet and things. And that in particular stands out to me. Like how did you recreate the helmet in particular?
Yeah. So I'm pretty sure the original one was welded steel. I'm guessing. So mine is, I think it's a gigantic PVC pipe, because it's just a, when you get shapes like that, like just a cylinder, it's almost always easier to find an existing like pipe or, you know, or sheet of plastic or something like, you know, so you don't have to like model the whole thing in CAD and do everything like that. So, I think it's like a gigantic, like 10 inch diameter piece of PVC pipe. And then it's all the welding on there is just sort of sculpted with like epoxy putty, and you know, it's all painted to look like metal.
Wow.
It looks pretty convincing. I asked, so I had friends at the Smithsonian at that time, and I know Wiley Post's suit is in their collection there, but I asked if they, you know, had any good photographs, but they didn't. Apparently it's in such horrible condition now that it just sits in like a, whatever their, it's not exactly a freezer, but there is their storage system. And they don't like to take it out.
Wow. Yeah. You've mentioned, working with the Smithsonian. Are you acquainted with, Jennifer Levasseur out there by any chance?
No, I don't.
Just throwing that out there. She's a good friend of the show and has been on and spoken at our museum and everything. She's one of the curators in the space section. I believe she's full-time curator of the Discovery now.
Oh, cool. Yeah. So I mostly know the people who deal with the spacesuits.
Gotcha.
So Kathy Lewis and Lisa Young are the two primary spacesuit people there.
So, you know, you never know. It's a small enough world to begin with.
Yeah, I'm sure someday I'll meet her. But
well, maybe we'll help you out there. That'd be great. She's a great person to know. So we're getting close to the end here, Ryan. But I do want to ask you a two-part question, and that is: do you have just an all-time favorite suit, whether you've recreated it or built it yourself or not? And I'd like you to answer that both on the fact side and the fiction side.
Oh, okay. Well, I mean, my favorite suit is definitely the Apollo spacesuit, the A7L that, you know, that was worn from Apollo 11 through Apollo 14. Then they changed the design a little bit, which I also like, but I'm partial to that original A7L suit. And I think ever since I saw the movie Apollo 13, when they're wearing those suits, I just had a strange obsession with it. I had to have one. I made a replica of an Apollo suit when I was 14, and I still have that one. I actually did a tested video with Adam Savage about that suit. You could probably find it somewhere online, but yeah, I've had like this near lifelong obsession with that suit. I don't know why. I think part of it is that, so when I saw Apollo 13, I was born in 1981, so I grew up with the shuttle, and that was space travel to me. I knew that we had gone to the moon, because I had seen, you know, the picture of Buzz Aldrin, you know, that famous man on the moon photo. But I didn't know anything about how we got there or, you know, the suits they wore. And so when I saw the movie Apollo 13, it was kind of mind blowing. So I didn't know that the Saturn V was the rocket that took us to the moon. Like I'd seen pictures of it before, but I didn't know there was a little capsule on top. I didn't know that man on the moon picture, you know, it shows Buzz with the whole backpack and the Leva, the gold visor and the overshoes. I didn't realize that was a modular suit. And that's the same suit that they're wearing at launch, just with some extra parts that they add onto it. So, you know, when they're like sticking the bubble helmets on and that suiting up scene, I was just fascinated by it. And I just kind of kicked off this lifelong obsession with that suit. So, I mean, that's definitely my favorite suit, on the nonfiction side. On the fiction side, I don't know if I can choose one, but two kind of come to mind. And the first one I have done a replica of, and it's the suit that they wear in Star Trek in the episode The Tholian Web. So I don't know if you remember that episode at all.
Sure, yeah, original series and Kirk suiting up.
Yeah, they're wearing these like very like janky looking silver suits with these like pill shaped helmets that just have a screen on them. I love that suit partly because it looks so bad. So I go to Star Trek convention sometimes and I made a replica of that suit for the convention. And there's just a big humor aspect to it because, you know, the costumes from the original series are kind of silly looking by today's standards. But I really like that suit. It was clearly inspired by some of the suits of the day, like Mercury and Apollo. There's some weird, like metallic colored fittings on the front. But it's just something kind of crazy. I actually had a chance to. So the guy who bought guy bought William Shatner's costume from that episode at an auction, but it was missing the helmet. So I made a replacement helmet for that, and it was actually it was our friend Tom Spina was doing this restoration.
Oh wow!
And he asked me to make the helmet for it and some various other parts. So that was fun. So that's one suit that comes to mind. And the other suit is probably from the same era, and it's the 2001 spacesuit.
Oh, costume. Sure.
Very, nice. Very iconic suit.
Orange suits and that helmet that's got that kind of a point to it with the glass face and everything.
Yeah, I would like to make a replica of that suit someday. I mean, I just don't really – I don't have any time. I wish I sometimes I would just, you know, I didn't have to, you know, have a business and make all these suits for other people because I would just, you know, do all these crazy things for myself. But someday I can carve out some time to maybe make a replica of that suit. I've seen some people have done that before, but I'd kind of like to do my own. Yeah, I think those are the two suits that it's interesting. They're both from the same era,
right?
About late '60s. And one is a very like high budget, nice looking suit. And one is very low budget and kind of cheap looking. So
But they both represent that forward-looking attitude that pervaded, you know, so much of the kind of the first half or the middle of the 20th century, and certainly influenced by the advent of the space age. And I can safely say you're among friends who appreciate that piece of it as well.
Yeah. That's great. I love retro stuff, I think, as you can tell, and that's kind of the era that I always go to.
Yeah, that's terrific. Well, Ryan, we are just about out of time, but we want to thank you once again for taking the time to join us today. This has been really interesting episode, a little off the beaten path for us, but so much fun to get to know you and to get to know the person behind this beautiful artifact that we have displayed in the museum. And so we're grateful to you for that and lucky to be able to display your work. If people want to see some other examples of your work across multiple media, what's the best way to do that?
Well, you can go to my website, ryannagata.com, or you can go to my Instagram where I, you know, post kind of what I'm working on. So it's more up to date. And that's just, Ryan Nagata on Instagram.
Terrific. Well, that's great. Well, Ryan, thanks once again. And thanks to everyone out there for listening. We sure appreciate that. Thanks to all of you who take the time to leave us reviews on iTunes and Stitcher and all the other places you consume your podcasts. We really look forward to seeing those. We also welcome email feedback. You can send that directly to feedback@eaa.org. And you can find a comment section below every episode's dedicated page on our Hangar Flying blog, which is at inspire.eaa.org. So with that, thanks once again to everyone for listening, to our guest Ryan, to everybody who works so hard to make this show possible. And we look forward to catching up to you next time when you're cleared to land on the green dot.